relationships to disclose that I know of. And that in this talk, I'm going to talk about some. Is this correct? It's going to start floating? Okay. Some off-label use of drugs, digoxin and potassium chloride, but I do not have any endorsement of any clinical protocol. And I just want to thank all of my co-presenters here because I feel like this is a very difficult topic to talk about. I actually had some nervousness coming up here as a non-clinician, as a non-lawyer, talking about a policy and surgical procedures. It's a little bit daunting. And I think when Tracy talks about the challenges of being an advocate for second trimester abortion, this is something that we can all, at least I would think at APHA, understand that it is difficult when the world is full of landmines around this issue to talk about it. So hopefully by the end of all of these talks, you'll leave with a little bit more familiarity, with a little more clarity, and better questions, I would think, about second trimester abortion than what you came with. So I'm going to talk about the practice changes in response to the federal abortion ban that occurred in Massachusetts. So Tracy gave a really great background on the Supreme Court history of abortion policy. The first attempted bans on so-called partial birth abortion happened in 1995 and 1997. Congress passed, tried to pass a similar law at this time, and the law was vetoed by Clinton. Gonzalez versus Carhart is the most recent, like I said, in the long history of abortion-related Supreme Court decisions. The ban on so-called partial birth abortion was attempted first in 1995 and 97, and then it was upheld by Gonzalez and Carhart in 2007. So you may hear people say that the partial birth abortion ban is a ban on a non-existent procedure because there is no medically recognized procedure called partial birth abortion, so that's actually true. However, many people interpret the law to refer to intact dilation and extraction, or DNX. Unfortunately, the law is sufficiently vague to make it very difficult to actually interpret as DNX procedures. So what I hope you'll take away from this talk is that a poorly written ban can have a real impact on the work that clinicians do, even when they're not supposed to be impacted or targeted by the ban. Does that make sense, sir? Okay. So according to the 2003 definition of a partial birth abortion, so-called partial birth abortion, this is an abortion in which the person performing the abortion deliberately and intentionally vaginally delivers a living fetus until the entire fetal head is outside the body of the mother or any part of the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother for the purpose of performing an overt act that the person knows will kill the partially delivered living fetus. Now, when I read this definition as a non-lawyer and a non-doctor, I have to say it is a persuasive definition. It is a persuasive sounding law. But I think there are a lot of grave concerns with respect to this law that can be understood even by a lay audience. One of the ways in which I was able to come to understand the considerations of clinicians when they think about the procedures that they use in the later second trimester is a comment that I heard at the National Abortion Federation Risk Management meeting in 2007. I think a number of people actually were here at that meeting. And the clinician said the cervix is sacred. So the thing to remember about the partial birth abortion ban is that while a safe abortion ends the pregnancy while protecting the woman's cervix, partial birth abortion ban is a law that is putting clinicians in a very untenable position where the procedure that they need to use to provide a woman a safe procedure is going to come at odds with the law. And so they may be finding themselves in a position where they have to consider the law, which is vague, at the time that they're providing the abortion, instead of considering the woman's physical health and her needs at the time of the abortion. And protection of the cervix is just one example of the problems with the law. Here are some others. Here's an overview of the potential problems. Number one is difficult to interpret. There's no reference to gestational age or viability. There's no health exemption. There's no guidance on how to change practices in order to comply with the ban or how to document compliance. And there's this question of what is intentionally intentional in the ban. Also, this is the first federal law about abortion that includes a criminal liability. And civil liability can be tripped by not only the individual woman who has received the quote-unquote partial birth abortion, but also her family, her parents, or her partner, her spouse. That is, doctors can be sued by any of these people. So there were a number of organizations and individuals who gave testimony in the Supreme Court, and ACOG released a press release on April 18, 2007, suggesting that the law will chill doctors from providing a wide range of procedures used to perform induced abortions or to treat cases of miscarriage and will gravely endanger the health of women in this country. Now, there are two implications that are covered in this ACOG press release. The first is that it's going to chill providers from providing abortion. The second is that it's going to have grave implications for women's health. So what we're addressing in the course of this study is the impact on clinical practice. We were not able to look at the second. So in the following study, we had several hypotheses on the impact of abortion practice, the impact of the ban on abortion practice. First, we hypothesized that there will be a decrease in providers, a reduction in the gestational age at which providers are willing to provide abortion procedures, an increase in the use of agents to induce fetal demise. And that's referring back to the fact that a live fetus, so if you can stop the fetal heartbeat prior to having the abortion, theoretically the law would not be broken. So an increased use of agents to stop the fetal heartbeat, changes in cervical dilation so that you're ensuring that you're removing the fetus in parts as opposed to all in one piece, which is the intact aspect of the ban, and then changes in staffing and procedure attendance so that you can avoid being reported on by somebody who works with you, who is watching because they're a resident or something like that. The objective of our study was to measure changes in the abortion practice in one state with a diverse pool of providers, and also to pilot a study that we could use potentially on a national level, because as you've seen in, I think, Larry's and also in Tracy's talk, there's a huge diversity across states in terms of how and who provides abortion. So this particular state was chosen because they have a diverse pool of providers, but we know that this is not going to be generalizable to the nation. So we did a phone survey to key informants at facilities where second trimester abortion, that is abortions over 14 weeks, LMP, are performed in Massachusetts. These are facilities, so each facility may have more than one clinician, likely to have more than one clinician. So this is not all of the doctors or providers in the or clinicians in the area. This is the facilities where they're provided. We developed a list using the Massachusetts Department of Public Health reports and a statewide directory produced by the Abortion Access Project. This is Massachusetts. Located in the Northeast. It serves a wide geographic area because the adjacent states have lower, they have providers who provide abortion to lower gestational ages. So it's a referral site for places like Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Vermont, and Maine, which have lower gestational ages to which they provide abortion. It also has a manageable number of sites. It has 18 provider or facilities where abortion is provided, 17 of whom participated in this study. And it also provides Medicaid funding for women who are having abortions, although they have a funny law in Massachusetts that says any woman who has a Medicaid, who's using Medicaid to pay for her abortion, if she's after 18 weeks, she needs to be seen in a hospital. So that changes the provision of abortion in Massachusetts slightly from other states. Okay, so 17 of the 18 facilities participated in this study. 10 of these were hospital-based facilities, and 8 of these had training programs, either a fellowship or a residency program. 7 of them were non-hospital facilities. And the difference, the main difference is that the hospitals went later in gestational age, but the outpatient facilities provided more abortions. It's the main difference between the two. Okay. So one of our hypotheses was that there would be changes in the practices for inducing fetal demise or stopping the fetal heartbeat prior to the abortion. After the decision, five additional facilities introduced medications to induce fetal demise. At the time of this study, three facilities performed injections of digoxin at a median age of 18 weeks. Three performed injections of potassium chloride at a median gestational age of 20 weeks, and one uses digoxin and then uses KCL, which is potassium chloride, if the digoxin fails, beginning at a gestational age of 19 weeks. All of the facilities that we found that were using feticidal agents were hospitals, and none of the non-hospital providers were using feticidal agents prior to April 2007, and they are not using them currently. Other changes were that one hospital stopped providing DNA procedures except for in maternal and fetal indications. One hospital noted a marked decrease in the number of procedures, but they didn't believe that this was related to the ban. And two clinicians dropped the gestational age. The hospital that stopped providing any elective DNA procedures is located 47 miles from the nearest alternative abortion facility. For women who live close to this facility, the suspension of service is likely to increase the travel necessary to obtain a second trimester abortion. There were also some administrative changes among the providers. 11 consulted, or 65%, so more than 50%, consulted legal counsel. Three hospitals suspended services for 2 to 3 months, and three increased costs, and three reduced student involvement. And it's important to remember when we're seeing all of these changes happening at hospitals that post 18 weeks, if you're a low-income woman who's on Medicaid, that's where you're going. So there's a potential for a larger impact on low-income women. So reflecting on our hypotheses at the beginning of the study, we did see a decrease in providers. One hospital did stop providing quote-unquote elective. I want to put that in quotes because sometimes it doesn't feel elective when you're having an abortion, even if it's not for fetal indications or for your maternal health. Reduction in gestational age, we saw that two clinicians did reduce their gestational age at which they were willing to provide abortions. We did not see any changes in cervical dilation practices in the providers in this sample. We did see an increase in use in the acts used to induce fetal demise, especially in using feticidal agents such as digoxin and potassium chloride. And we saw that changes in staffing and procedure attendance at the hospitals also occurred. So one of the things that was really interesting, so we did see some changes that, you know, happened, and but there's a lot of challenges that occurred with doing this, because one of the things that we found is that we had several hypotheses going into this study. But it was really, really difficult to standardize responses across all these different kinds of providers. So I think, hindsight being 2020, we may have gotten better data, clearer data, had we done qualitative interviews, open-ended questions in this study, and done some more hypothesis generating rather than hypothesis testing in this study. Some of the challenges were, there were different protocols at clinics and hospitals for fetal abnormalities, that there may be varying practices at different facilities by providers, and that some providers were using inductions versus evacuations, and then they had different protocols for those as well. Also, as I said before, this study is not generalizable, so it's difficult to draw conclusions about the rest of the country. And it's also difficult to draw conclusions about the thing that we're probably the most concerned with, which is women's access to abortion care. Although it points us in some directions, it's not giving us a lot of information about what actually happened to women's access to abortion. We know that there's less facilities providing abortion. We don't know how that changed women's abortion behavior. The other thing that is that this points to is that it's a really challenging to present data about changes in response to a ban on abortion in the face of legal and criminal prosecution. Because we are very careful to not out the providers in this study. And so it's been a really challenging process for us to not want to out the providers in this study for the practices that they use, but at the same time wanting to examine the effects of the ban on clinical practice. So that's something to think about when you're conducting this kind of research. And I think I'm going to end there. So thank you for your time.
So it was a terrific set of papers. We did use up more than just Angel's time, but I do want to try to take a couple of questions, and then we'll promise on behalf of the panelists that they'll stick around for a few minutes in case there are some additional things that you want to check in about. Dr. Hearn?
Super important question, and I think for many of us, especially those of us who are at the University of California, this is exactly why we're located at the University of California, San Francisco. It's exactly why we're located at the University of California, San Francisco, is that we work hand in hand with our colleagues. All of these papers have been developed, all of these studies have been developed in side-by-side confrontation in mixed, what we consider to be multidisciplinary ways. I think it's super important to involve a clinician's perspective in all the work, as it is important to involve some
doctors. There's doctors up here that do this work.
I think it's really important not to assume that an examination of a healthcare service should be limited to any one discipline. I think it's just as limiting that we don't have a lawyer on this panel. I think it is just as limiting that we don't have a woman who receives abortion on this panel. I think the most important thing, which is why we've moved forward with a strategic plan, is that we absolutely believe that all of those perspectives need to be involved at an integral level. All of the recommendations in the strategic plan, all of the summaries and the analysis of the data, all of the collection of the data is done in consultation with all of those disciplines. And there are several, I think, clinician colleagues of mine who are in the audience who I think have invested in us the capacity to demonstrate and to report these findings. But in no way would we ever think that the unique perspective of a clinician should be avoided. And I wish this panel could have been 14 wide, but I would never want to say that any one discipline shouldn't be an integral part of being facile in talking about these issues. And I think that clinicians have a place in that, but I, as a sociologist, as a demographer, as a public health person, and Larry, are you a demographer by training? need to become increasingly facile in talking about this issue. So we welcome you on the panel. I wish that all of those disciplines could be there. But I want to be very clear that I think it is my burden as a non-clinician to be able to talk about this issue, and it is your burden as a clinician to be able to talk about the woman's perspective. And that is good, quality, multidisciplinary work, and I think that's why we do public health, because we believe in a multidisciplinary perspective.
I just wanted to add that there are two physicians who are co-authors on this study, and neither one of them were able to come and present. There are two physicians who are authors on our study, the study I just presented, and neither one of them was able to come. I think APHA is a challenging place for a lot of doctors to come to. So you have a question?
With all those different perspectives. Great. There were a few other questions. McGreen.
It's on our list of things. As I don't know if you sometimes heard me say, a white woman who lives in an apartment or who whatever, it's one of our questions is, where does she live if she has a home? Do you know? So Sandy Stonecipher, who's the project manager for the project, who does an amazing job, says there have been 2 homeless women in the study. And the big challenge will be keeping them. Yeah.
Hi.
The question of viability is a super important one, again, that's incredibly misunderstood. We talk a lot about the declining, you know, that there's this sort of line that's moved on viability. But there's a great literature review that was done by Sarah Kilpatrick that's looked at the data, and there really has been very little change in the survivability and long-term survivability at gestational. So while there are more fetuses surviving for very short periods of time, the long-term survivability line has declined almost nil. And this was really looked at, and this year the Parliament of the UK wanted to lower the gestational limit and really looked at this question because of the mythology we have, because we all hear about the 24-weeker who was born or the 22-weeker who was born, but the change in survivability is almost nil. I think it is important for us to engage in this question about whether or not and at what point we think that the state has the right to compel a woman to continue her pregnancy to birth. Because when we say viability, we don't mean that at that moment in time we induce delivery and we can keep the child alive. What we mean is at some point a woman's right to an abortion is trumped by the state, who must maintain her pregnancy until birth. So I think it is a super important question. And one, I think, because we're always fighting about abortion generally, we don't actually sit down and have a conversation about how we feel and what we mean. And I have a great Suzanne Popanoff, who's a clinician, and I don't want to say that I value the clinician's perspective. She says the way she makes a determination about when to not do it, at what point you don't do an abortion, is when she can look a woman in the eye and say, "You will be a mother." And I think that Diana's stories really talk about the material implications of forcing a woman to continue an unintended pregnancy to term. And so we need to unpack that viability mythology in a way that's real about the long-term survivability of early-born fetuses.
We are out of time, and I know people are feeling a little bit nervous about leaving, but again, the panelists who are able to stay will stay and take your questions. And again, as I said before, let's get the real information out there, because there is so much misinformation. Thank you for coming.
Dan. Nice to see you. I know who you are. I feel like we've only seen each other in person, like once or twice. But obviously, I use your work all the time, every day. Yeah, good to see you. Well, maybe if there's someone hoping to talk to me. We can sub you in since you had to go running out the door. If anybody comes up and they had questions about, all right, so you were coming to me. Yeah, okay, good. Nice to see you. Hey, how are you? Nice to see you. I was trying to know how you're doing. I'm loving it. I talked to a friend in New Jersey and an inch today, and I was sitting outside like getting burned, and I was like, you're going to kill me when you hear what I'm doing. Tell me what you're up to.
Well, right now, actually, after graduation, I got a 6-month fellowship. What even is urgent? I know it's good for me.
Spinach. I have certain jobs that I refer to as spinach jobs. Spinach jobs. That's all right.
I ended up doing that with the reality because really the issues that I felt that it was able to figure out with you, so they're like,
and then you've got it. Like, that's just something that is only going to be positive on your resume.
Right, and then I'll be looking for a job to deliver, but I think that only will help.
I think that's right. And where are you thinking about where in the country you want to be here?
You know, before I came here, I was thinking about location, but after coming here, I was going to learn more about the content.
You're only going to be portable for like a certain window in your life.
But then again, I'm starting to worry that as I am so portable that I'll never have roots anywhere.
Well, but you will. Shock it actually graduated from the department whatever. And she ended up in Iowa, and she got married in Iowa, and she just had a baby. And, you know, she said to me last year, she got the Young Professional Award. She's like, oh my God, who would have ever thought? But like, you know, you will, because something will hit in your life. And so I don't think you have to worry about that. I think it is smart to do the things that you care about, because I mean, you know, you're finding it right now. It's not as satisfying to do something that you feel isn't quite a match. And, you know, listen, if you have a couple of choices, then you can maybe find that alignment between a place you're interested in and, you're not going to make some place terrible, but I do think what you're saying is, like, such a big part of your day. You got to love the people. You got to, you know, be interested in the work.
I actually have a couple of everybody's lined up in Atlanta for next week.
Pedagogy of Sexuality Education. So speaking of getting back to what you love and care about, they sort of gave that to me so I could put up with doing some of the stuff that everybody knows I'm not interested in, but I'm willing to do administrative stuff. I like program planning. I like teaching. So if I could just teach, like, I would be phenomenal as an undergraduate, because, like, that's what I need to do. You know, if that's all I had to do, I would truly be happy. But that's not how these jobs go. But we're bringing in a lot of exciting work in the department with good meeting faculty. So it's good. In fact, I'm going right now to pull myself together. I'm having dinner with Jenny Higgins, who is going to come on. Yeah. I don't know if you went to the closure thing.
No, but I
that was the panel that she was going to do.
I was so focused on Nicole, which is one approach, but I missed out on some other things.
Yeah. That's all right. Well, listen, we've got lots of opportunities, and this is going to be a funny thing to bring up, but I feel like I wish I'd heard this a little earlier in my life, but Joan Rivers spoke at, she went to Barnard, and I was at my Barnard 15th reunion or whatever 5 years ago, and she said, listen, you guys, if I could tell you anything, it's all going to be fine. And I just felt like there was something about that. I passed that on to you because it's like,
Thank you. this. Ah, I fucking spoiled that.